Bienvenidos al podcast de la comunidad IoT Perú.
¿Te interesa el Internet de las Cosas?
¿La inteligencia artificial?
¿El blockchain?
¿Y otras tecnologías? Estás en el lugar correcto. Quédate.
With us today is Kathy Yori. She's an electrical engineer from University of Minnesota and did her master's in the same field at Stanford University. Previously, she has worked at companies like SRI, Sputnik, Qualcomm, Arduino, and Mozilla. Today, she's involved in several projects. First, the leadership team at Microblocks, second, board member at BeagleBoard, and third, early 2021, she joined CIDIRA as ecosystem engagement lead. Your career is very impressive, Kathy. Could you share with us what drives you and sparks your passion?
Well, I think I've always enjoyed tinkering and technology. You know, I was good at math, had a math teacher father. Probably from that, I've really always liked working with engineers or just being around engineers, you know, who share sort of tech interests. And although I've been in tech for a long while now, you can only solve so many things on your own. But when you work with other brilliant and talented people, that's when things really, you know, become exciting. Like, there's only so much I can do on my own, but working with a team of people, I think that's always been one of the things that drives me. And, you know, overall, I just like learning how you and others are trying to make the world a better place, what I'm doing. We share those interests. We become inspired by each other. And, you know, you inspired me the first time I talked to you about Zignar and what you're doing. And I'm probably ready for another catch up on that soon. So
thank you for that. Thank you so much. Yeah, totally. But when you have the chance to see someone else's approach that not necessarily matches with what you think or what you have in mind, it leads to better outcomes and greater results, right? That's part of the collaboration.
Right.
And so going to what you're doing at CIDIRA right now, I was reviewing that CIDIRA is a cutting edge corporation that is based in Silicon Valley. They have more than 60 employees that are focused on secure integration and orchestration of edge infrastructure using technologies like IoT, artificial intelligence, cloud, and more recently, distributed ledger technologies. How has been your experience working at CIDIRA?
Well, it's been surprisingly fun considering CIDIRA is really helping industries where I have very little experience or domain knowledge, like take oil and gas, for example, one of the big early customers. And even though I don't really know anything about oil rigs and digging wells and stuff, and I don't know if you remember the Colonial Pipeline breach, this technology, you know, solving technology in the field is hard because it's hard to deploy, it's hard to secure, it's hard to maintain. You can't get tech people who want to be in all these harsh environments. And so, you know, I don't have time to explain everything about CIDIRA, but what's fun is actually being able to say, oh, but I'm a technologist, but I don't know about that, but we can help each other. You know, we can help you, oil and gas industry, make things better. And so that's kind of makes me happy to work at a company that's helping industries move to avoid cyber attacks, ransomware and their edge infrastructure. And then the other new part of it for me is learning more about microservices and cloud native style computing, you know, getting away from these monolithic desk, you know, OSs and pushing out cloud native style software to the edge. That's new to me. So I'm really having fun, basically.
So is oil and gas the only industry that CIDIRA is focused on?
Manufacturing is a big one. Retail, just, you know, where you have to deploy computers all over the place, distributed all over the place, rather than having to push IT people to all those places, you can actually centralize your IT because the IT person can be at headquarters owning the bare metal that's been deployed, deploying the software to it from a centralized infrastructure. And it's a TLS tunnel. You know, TLS is what we use for HTTPS, and so you have basically a TLS link is between that edge node and your headquarters of your IT. And that's the only thing the edge node will talk to. So I'm pretty happy about, you know, doing something good for industry and having fun, you know, learning about all this bleeding edge technology that makes it happen.
Amazing. Amazing. As I mentioned, you also are part of BeagleBoard and MicroBlocks Fan. The first one is a nonprofit that creates open hardware to provide education around the design and use of open source software and hardware. And the second one is a blocks programming language for physical computing inspired by Scratch. Could you tell us what makes these projects special?
People, and that they benefit education. People-wise, it's just like working with John Maloney. He was the lead developer for Scratch for the first 11 years, right? And then he got into physical computing. And so now with MicroBlocks, I get to engage with him. You know, we have weekly calls with other brilliant developers to improve MicroBlocks, deploy, you know, how can we get it in more schools? How can kids learn? It's a nonprofit. None of us are making money on it. And it's just so inspiring. And then also this year, or was it last year, got invited to the BeagleBoard team and, you know, to add some diversity and just more brilliant engineers doing great stuff with positive outcomes for just education and innovation in a very open way. I have a hard time saying no to stuff like that.
And may I ask how you met each other? Like, it was the project or you had another community? How this ended up happening?
Usually it happens when your career is long enough, you meet people along the way and then they know someone else. And for example, when I was at Arduino, I met Bernat Romagosa, who's in Barcelona, brilliant developer. Now he works on MicroBlocks. He also works on Snap. He introduced me to John Maloney, Jens Monig, you know, just it cascades from people you've worked with. And when you work with, you know, engineering teams, you find the best people and the ones you want to keep up with. And then I keep up with those people. And so opportunities come to you. And just like even how I got to Zedita, it was like a brother of a guy I at Mozilla on an ex-Mozvitz channel. And then he was like, oh, my brother has this Linux Foundation Edge project. And they're looking, and I was like, oh, that sounds fun. So it's people you know, mostly.
Yeah, yeah. Just by experience, projects and reference that just are floating around, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. So let's change gears and move into tech specifically. I can tell you, well, I can see that you have lots of experience in open source initiatives. But why open source? What's the potential of this approach?
Well, I think, you know, before the terms were floated about, you know, kind of pre-Linux, I think growing up, you know, it's just like software and it was, you shared how you built something and you shared programs and stuff. But I think, you know, back in the 90s and then getting into Linux, I started to understand what open source was all about. You know, in the early web days, you know, view source, right? Oh, look at how they did this HTML page and look at these tags. And as HTML was going so fast, to be able to keep up with how the cool, newer, beautiful pages worked, you just viewed the source. And so, and then I think it really hit me hard when I was working at Qualcomm, a silicon company. When you don't have good open source and up in that case, upstream kernel technology, you're just holding your customers back. So the upstream kernel drivers of early one was ATH5K, but ATH9K, ATH10K, now ATH11K. It's like with that, companies can do whatever they want. Without it, you're limited to the whatever insights like that one small company did. Instead, I've seen just amazing like wireless mesh and power, dynamic power adjustments and stuff. All the cool innovations occur on these open source software implementations. And, you know, I'm totally sold on open source for sure. And yeah, it's just better for education, everything. Yeah.
Yeah. It's marvelous to see how companies like, for example, Microsoft that were so closed, with their code, back in the 90s and early 2000s now have made a huge migration to open source with the purchase of GitHub, for example, more recently, and the change of the strategy.
VS Code is a good tool. Yeah, I think it's really that younger people coming up with that knowledge of, you know, this is why, you know, this is open. Then they get into companies and then they're slowly transforming, hopefully. You know, there's still room for proprietary technology when you have a real business knowledge niche, stuff like that. But all of the sort of base platform and sort of building the, you know, cool innovations of the world are always sort of built on open, I think.
Yeah, even the space station runs on open source software. TVs, phones, everything.
Exactly.
Yeah. So how can a, from your point of view, how can a startup or a small nonprofit benefit from releasing open source code? What are your key considerations to build a business model based on it?
Yeah, so the tricky part still is making sure you, if you're a for-profit company, still making sure you have an edge. Is it you're going to do service, software as a service, like a SaaS model? Is it support services? Is it professional services? Is it a product that you bundle it so that, just like even as ZD, this EVOS, this open, completely open source under the Linux Foundation edge, runs at the edge. It's all open source. There's no vendor lock-in. And yet big companies, they don't want to have their own people, you know, figuring it all out. And so there's a company behind that. And so all open source, there's usually lots of system integrators or, you know, specialists that can make money. But then there are others where you're just running a SaaS model. It's so hard to say without looking at the sort of the thing, but try to make sure you have a business model if you're doing it for a profit. And then if it's a nonprofit, it's super easy. You just make sure you work with the best and the brightest people and make sure you have a really good collaborative team, because team dynamics in open source projects can get difficult, can definitely, you know, that can be very tricky.
Yeah, no, that's good info and things to consider. And I say it because right now at Signar, we are also going through the same. We are obviously releasing open source software, but we are having these conversations on what exactly we are going to release, how we're going to release it. We have had some, I would say, niche, cutting edge progress on the things that we're building. And now we are open those as services to the community, at least for free, without charging for it, to see how they use it and receive feedback without releasing the code yet. Mm-hmm. But on our plan or our roadmap is to eventually release it, because that's the only way we see that this will evolve into something greater.
Right, right. If there's something that can be improved, when you expose it to others, they'll improve upon it. And you'll improve it upon it. And then you just have to make sure you can find a way for companies that you serve, you know, you're helping them leverage this great technology and, you know, make sure you trademark everything you can, you know, the names of things, the ownership of it, just make sure. I mean, that's one of the big things is Signar, you know, people have to know this is where the great technology is being managed and maintained, and even though you have a community around you, you're the go-to company for this type of technology.
Yeah, I think you said it right, with you being the go-to company, because when you release something like a project, open source project, yeah, it can be copied, but the community and also the customers will recognize this.
Who led it? Yeah.
Who led it? Right. Who was the first one? And then even if someone comes with a greater idea to improve it, because you had the guts to do it first, then you get that in return. Totally. Awesome. And on the other hand, what is your impression and experience with open hardware? What is the process and what are the benefits around it?
Yeah, well, similarly to software, when you can innovate on ideas and build upon them, open hardware, I think, is very is excellent in the educational realm and in the innovation realm. Like if everyone kept their designs to themselves, it's a real black magic art, right? And if you can't learn from others, like that view source example with the hardware, it's the same thing. And what I'm really excited about on hardware is seeing that RISC-V is coming along, because you know it was open to the PCB and then the silicon was closed, right? And so there hasn't been, I think, as good of innovation at the silicon layer, and that's a complicated, you know, manufacturing process and so forth. But RISC-V is coming along, and it's pretty inspiring that people can start designing more custom chips, and who knows what we'll see in the manufacturing realm if we can make those things better and better. But that could really transform technology, because it's very complex. But if we share the knowledge, then innovation happens faster.
Yeah. What I've seen from the agriculture industry is that, for example, farmers are having a hard time trying to just support the hardware or repair the hardware that they got from a proprietary vendor. Because everything is closed and no documentation is released, maybe if it's just a resistance that might be burned. You have to toast it and purchase a whole new thing, right?
Yeah, even cars have gone that way. Oh, your whole electronic control unit has to be, you know, thrown out. But and the agriculture, I mean, talk about inventors and innovators, you know, they have problems to solve and they're not the same everywhere. So you don't want to lock people into one proprietary solution if it doesn't fit their needs. You want them to be able to adjust it, modify it, apply it to their special considerations of the environment, the terrain, everything, the weather.
Yeah, it's like, well, I'm bringing or going back to agriculture, but this happens in all industries. And usually when you have people from the trade, the ethos is always try to repair it first, right?
Yeah, like
the right to repair. And if you try it if it's too expensive to get it done, then, well, yes, you contemplate to purchase a new one.
I'm dating myself, but it used to be once upon a time when you bought like an alarm clock radio, you'd get the electronic schematic for it. And like if a transistor burned out, you could actually replace it and put in your own.
Wow.
Once upon a time that actually I opened up my electronics.
Oh yeah, no, that doesn't, definitely is not part
doesn't
of
happen anymore.
The manual. None of the products I've bought have that.
Have schematics, schematics, yeah. Manuals with them, I know.
Estás escuchando el podcast de la comunidad IoT Perú.
I remember, I think when I was children, when I was a child, I think that I've seen the schematics of my old fridge somewhere. Yeah, all the resistance and all the schematics. Not anymore.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. So could you tell us about also your experience with W3C Web of Things standard WOOT that was used in Mozilla IoT framework? What was the paradigm behind to create the standard, and what was your role back then?
That's another classic example of where I didn't really have experience with the web going into working for Mozilla, but I brought my experience from like Qualcomm Wi-Fi routers, and they wanted to deploy smart home technology, but in a very secure way. And got on the because it's a web company, got on the bandwagon of the W3C's Web of Things project, which says, let's, rather than having all this disparate, not interoperable things, don't, you know, only one vendor, you can buy one vendor's things and it goes with that vendor and that's it. The Web of Things idea was, let's turn it all into JSON, just like web services. And so we can exchange vendor A data with vendor B data. And we put together a project that would run on a Raspberry Pi, or, you know, and then it was Docker containerized, so you could run it on anything, packages for other Linux distros. It was a fantastic project. The problem is Mozilla kept losing market share to Chrome versus Firefox. It's just not going so well. So they had to cut the whole emerging technologies division eventually. And that's where some of this cool innovation was occurring. So now it's a community project, and I still run my own smart home with it. And, you know, some of the original developers still, you know, engaged even in the W3C stuff. So cross my fingers, I hope this project lasts even without corporate backing. I hope some company that has enough resources keeps it going, because it's really awesome.
Yeah, no, the idea behind Woot, or Web of Things.
Yeah, the Web of Things.
Super, I would say the scope or the impact is going to be huge for developers and also for machine learning that could be artificial intelligence that could use and leverage this. Because instead of reading the JSON structurally, you can read it semantically. Yeah. So that's the key benefit. It means that less administration or code is required to play with the JSONs, or
right, and you don't have to know a priori what data you're receiving. The structure of the Web of Things is a certain structure, and there's properties, actions, and events. And so, for example, the Gateway GUI just pulls in that data and puts together a user interface over it. From a web services, from a logic and rules based, you're just looking for this property going above that amount, and then take some action. You don't have to stop and hard code everything. It's web services. It's dynamic, so it's a really good way to handle IoT data, I think.
Yeah, totally. We are looking into it and developing the things definition and the domain to use it. But it's inspiring because when we were playing with the JSONs, and as these were growing, because we started to add more variables and more things, we were just going through or reading arrays that as soon as you move one variable or one parameter, it becomes a mess for the backend.
Yeah, then somebody else has to change something. Yeah, you don't want hard stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So if you would have the power to change something about the internet that bothers you, what that would be?
Well, one thing that bothers me these days is misinformation, disinformation, you know, just like how the internet, social media, that whole, like, we have this great technology and it's being sort of abused by government, political, moral. I mean, there's just so many things. Like, I wish we had a fix for that. And I also worry about, even, you know, I don't know the details, but I read stuff about China and just the surveillance, the lack of privacy. You kind of worry about people or governments in positions of power being able to abuse their and keep their position of power based on their use of technology over other people. So I'd say the internet, you know, privacy, disinformation. And that's why I like working for a company that focuses on security, because, you know, if we can secure the data so that it's not able to be, I don't know, that's a really tough problem.
Tampering, data tampering, and even... I think it's common knowledge now that even the fact checkers are being intentionally shift. It's like you click on something to check, and then you see that there is no references on that. It's just someone's opinion without any supporting background or research, and then it's on even mainstream titles or like mainstream news, and then people take that for granted because you just saw it and you say, okay, yeah, this is likely true because I always follow this, and they are a large corporation. They have this fleet of people with ties. But the problem is that this misinformation creates lack of confidence with the institutions that are supposed to back it up or, or back, right? Back So it's a very hard, I guess that's...
That's a hard one, I know.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that it's a good one to get done and fixed, but it's a hard one to go through it, especially because there is like a large, I would say, large interest involved in this. It's not just one company. It's not just one government.
Right.
So it's very, very, very tough.
Especially those of us who like see technology's ability to make the world a better place. And then we cringe at technology's ability to make the world a worse place. I mean, that's the hard part. It's like, I don't want to give up the challenge of making it better. And why can't we get people to like not try to make it worse? I don't know.
Yeah. So like identity probably is decentralized identities, or in general, the identity management of internet users.
Yeah.
Most of our current challenges are around that.
Yeah. There's a lot of smart, great people working on various social, you know, aspects of this. I can't say I'm contributing highly to it, but I love following it and cheering them on, everything that can do something to protect our privacy and so forth. So
yeah, it's there's a good book I was about to buy. It's a Capital Surveillance Society, I think. Capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Surveillance capitalism.
Yeah, surveillance capitalism. Right? Yeah, I heard a review about that recently. Sounds good.
Yeah, it sounds good. Okay, well, IoT has many components, and these can be very, very complex. What should be the approach for an early stage startup who want to solve this problem using IoT? Like for any industry in general, what are the things that they have to keep in mind to address that problem using the technology?
Yeah. So I think the for this IoT is so diverse. Like there are cell phones and everybody has a cell phone and it's a billion and billion dollar market, you know, billions of cell phones and so forth. IoT instead is a little bit more of a maker phenomena, where just like even in agriculture, solving one problem of a certain type of, you know, potatoes or something and how they are harvested is different from something else. And so you really have to be innovative. And that's where IoT, I think you just, as a startup, you got to have the domain experts. If you're solving certain types of problems, solve them really well, simplify it for whoever's going to buy it from you. Make sure you have, you're solving that pain. You know, it's a classic in anything with startups. It's like, make sure that somebody you're solving a problem for them. And then, you know, and that's just the, like, that's just common sense for all startups. And then IoT in specific, make sure you're flexible. Like don't lock yourself into one type of hardware or chip or technology. It's like, leverage this wealth of openness around the maker ethic, the professional hobbyists, and then, you know, just find people who are just brilliant innovators and tinkerers to solve those solutions and keep refining it. Because it's not just solving the problem, it's making it cost effective. Like you have to make this thing and then make it cheap enough that it can still solve the problem and you can still make money. Those, you know, it's challenging, but it's super fun. So I'm sure you guys are having fun.
Yeah, totally, totally. I think Cesar also has a question.
Okay.
So, Cesar.
Yeah. Thanks, Gianfranco. So my English is not so good, but I will try to ask my question in English.
Better than my Spanish. No hablo español, parlo italiano.
Okay, I would like to know more about microblogs. If you have, if you work with schools, pub labs, or any public institutions?
Yeah, I basically volunteered. Like, I did a volunteer summer camp this program. I volunteered to teach it in some schools. There's various microcontrollers. One of the most popular ones that's going gangbusters now is the MicroBit. But Adafruit, the new Raspberry Pi Pico is supported by MicroBlocks. So the whole sort of Arduino phenomena was awesome. But that was at a post-university design institute where Arduino got started. It helped like professionals who are artists and creative types, designers, use microcontrollers for lighting and music and stuff like that. But that's still a knowledgeable adult. Now with MicroBlocks, you can take these far more powerful microcontrollers that are already built in with sensors and actuators. And you can have kids make their Halloween costumes starting in fifth grade. I mean, it's phenomenal what MicroBlocks does because they've already learned Scratch. And John now is focused entirely on microcontrollers. And I've seen these kids, like, they're playing music, they're making games, they're playing lights, they're learning about gestures and motion control. And, you know, I wrote a whole kit, packet, actually. There's a classroom kit. And so, I love playing with MicroBlocks. I can never get enough. There's everything from the basic, you know, LED display down to flashlight tag, two-button radio texting, you know, the ambulance, the logging data. You can do physics experiments, and they have radios on board. I mean, MicroBlocks and microcontrollers are just the best for education because it really leads into IoT. Like, what's IoT? It's innovation. It's sensing things and then understanding the data and then taking actions based on it. So, like, I want every kid in the world to use microcontrollers to instrument the physical world around us and understand how it works. And, you know, just, yeah. I think it's the best thing we could possibly do. And it's translatable. It's free, open source. It's already translated in many different languages. If it's not in your language, all you have to do is take the language translation file and it will populate it.
And if any teacher or student want to know about MicroBlocks,
the website is microblocks.fun. So MicroBlocks, just like it sound, no funky spelling there. And then .fun is the URL. And there are projects with different degrees of difficulty, and there are languages you can select. And we're working on Bernat, who's the guy in Barcelona, is working on something where you would be able to like drag and drop examples from the web, from your web browser into your MicroBlocks palette. And then like you can even drag an example that's written in English or that I created, let's say, and you drag it into your MicroBlocks development environment. And if your environment is using Spanish, then it will just take my blocks and it will rename the blocks to the Spanish equivalent, even though it pulled, because underneath is really opcodes. There's, you know, so the language is just served up by the tool on the user interface, but the MicroBlocks themselves are just opcodes. They come all the way down to ones and zeros. So I think it's going to transform education just like these boards have already done. So,
if a teacher wants to add his project with new sensors to the MicroBlocks fund repositories or project, like how does that look like? What are the usual steps for them to?
Yeah. So some people have found out about us and just, you know, sent an email. It's not really big enough to have a real active forum yet. So we've got engaged with email. There's a guy that works with us very closely in Turkey who's made a new library for OLED displays using the blocks themselves. People get involved and then we try to get ambassadors. So I've tried to arrange ambassadors around the world in different countries. I part of this techwomen.org program that's in Africa, Central Asia, and the Middle East. And I spread the word as much as I can and give them hardware whenever I can, and then just teach workshops to kids and or teachers or you know, it's just my volunteer fun time where I find opportunities whenever I can.
Oh, but that's amazing. That's
yeah.
That's
so you guys are part of it. Spread the word. Let's get the next generation to instrument the world and for the making it a better place, right?
Yeah, no, for our listeners within and without the IoT community of Latin America, there is a lot of teachers and educators and people who is involved in education in general that I think they will take value from this.
Good. Yeah. Good. I'm glad.
That's great. Well, Kathy, thank you so much. It has been such a enlightening conversation.
Gracias.
No, de nada, de nada. Thank you so much again. I hope to have you again sometime in the future to talk about other projects or things that might be passionate about.
Good. Okay. Sounds great.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for hosting this.
Si te ha gustado este podcast, compártelo. Y si quieres estar atento a todas nuestras novedades y no perderte ninguno de nuestros podcasts, síguenos en redes sociales y únete a la comunidad IoT Perú. Hasta la próxima.